Hello, patrons, and welcome to what appears to be becoming a regular Monday podcast of Bram Stoker's Dracula. As usual, I've done this recording this morning, kept it to, you know, a relatively short length, because if it weren't a relatively short length, if it were a long podcast, then it would not be out on Monday, and it probably wouldn't be anything close to regular. And, you know, that way lies madness. That way lies getting bogged down and, you know, taken away from my real work, which, of course, is under and Flinch Underground. And in case you missed it, the most recent episode of Underground, episode 20, went live last Friday, which is a terrible day to actually post a podcast, especially Friday night, because nobody's paying any attention to Patreon or their email or anything on a Friday night. Everyone's too busy doing other stuff. But take my word for it, it is there, so do check that out. Okay, so Dracula then. Last time we had Jonathan in the castle, and he went for a bit of a stroll and he fell asleep and woke up, and, you know, Dracula's brides, at least that's what the movies call them, Dracula's three brides were, you know, getting ready to snack on him when Dracula appeared and basically said, "Hands off, he's mine." Great band, The Beat, weren't they? "Hands off, he's mine, da-da-da-da-da-da." Well, of course, Dracula didn't say that, but it would have been amusing if he had. Anyway, Dracula said, "Hands off, he's mine. I have plans for him, and you can have him when I finish with him." And that was it. Poor old Jonathan, deeply aggrieved, not sure if he was asleep or not, passes out. And it's from that point that we begin this episode 5 of
Dracula by Bram Stoker. Read by Mike Bennett.
Episode 5. Chapter 4. Jonathan Harker's Journal, Continued. I awoke in my own bed. If it be that I had not dreamt, the Count must have carried me here. I tried to satisfy myself on the subject, but could not arrive at any unquestionable result. To be sure, there were certain small evidences, such as that my clothes were folded and laid by in a manner which was not my habit. My watch was still unwound, and I am rigorously accustomed to wind it the last thing before going to bed, and many such details. But these things are no proof, for they may have been evidences that my mind was not as usual, and, from some cause or another, I had certainly been much upset. I must watch for proof. Of one thing I am glad. If it was that the Count carried me here and undressed me, he must have been hurried in his task, for my pockets are intact. I'm sure this diary would have been a mystery to him which he would not have brooked. He would have taken or destroyed it. As I look around this room, although it has been to me so full of fear, it is now a sort of sanctuary, for nothing can be more dreadful than those awful women who are waiting to suck my blood. 18th May. I have been down to look at that room again in daylight, for I must know the truth. When I got to the doorway at the top of the stairs, I found it closed. It had been so forcibly driven against the jamb that part of the woodwork was splintered. I could see that the bolt of the lock had not been shot, but the door is fastened from the inside. I fear it was no dream, and must act on this surmise. 19th of May. I am surely in the toils. Last night the Count asked me in the suavest tones to write 3 letters, one saying that my work here was nearly done and that I should start for home within a few days, another that I was starting on the next morning from the time of the letter, and the third that I had left the castle and arrived at Bistritz. I would fain have rebelled, but felt that in the present state of things it would be madness to quarrel openly with the Count whilst I am still so absolutely in his power, and to refuse would be to excite his suspicion and to arouse his anger. He knows that I know too much, and that I must not live lest I be dangerous to him. My only chance is to prolong my opportunities. Something may occur which will give me a chance to escape. I saw in his eyes something of that gathering wrath which was manifest when he hurled that fair woman from him. He explained to me that posts were few and uncertain, and that my writing now would ensure ease of mind to my friends, and he assured me, with so much impressiveness, that he would countermand the later letters which would be held over at Bistritz until due time, in case chance would admit of my prolonging my stay, that to oppose him would have been to create new suspicion. I therefore pretended to fall in with his views and asked him what dates I should put on the letters. He calculated a minute and then said, "The first should be June 12, the second June 19, and the third June 29. I know now the span of my life. God help me. 28th May. There is a chance of escape, or at any rate of being able to send word home. A band of Tsigane have come to the castle and are encamped in the courtyard. These Tsigane are gypsies. I have notes of them in my book. They are peculiar to this part of the world, though allied to the ordinary gypsies all the world over. There are thousands of them in Hungary and Transylvania who are almost outside the law. They attach themselves, as a rule, to some great noble or boyar, and call themselves by his name. They are fearless and without religion, save superstition, and they talk only in their own varieties of the Romany tongue. I shall write some letters, and shall try to get them to have them posted. I have already spoken to them through my window to begin an acquaintanceship. They took their hats off and made obeisance, and many signs which, however, I could not understand any more than I could their spoken language. I have written the letters. Mina's is in shorthand, and I simply ask Mr. Hawkins to communicate with her. To her I have explained my situation, but without the horrors which I may only surmise. It would shock and frighten her to death were I to expose my heart to her. Should the letters not carry, then the Count shall not yet know my secret or the extent of my knowledge. I have given the letters. I threw them through the bars of my window with a gold piece, and made what signs I could to have them posted. The man who took them pressed them to his heart and bowed, and then put them in his cap. I could do no more. I stole back to the study and began to read. As the Count did not come in, I have written here. The Count has come. He sat down beside me and said in his smoothest voice as he opened two letters, "The Tsigane has given me these, of which, though I know not whence they come, I shall, of course, take care. See," he must have looked at it, "one is from you, and to my friend Peter Hawkins. The other..." Here he caught sight of the strange symbols as he opened the envelope, and the dark look came into his face, and his eyes blazed wickedly. "The other is a vile thing, an outrage upon friendship and hospitality. It is not signed. Well, so it cannot matter to us." And he calmly held letter and envelope in the flame of the lamp till they were consumed. Then he went on, "The letter to Hawkins I shall, of course, send on, since it is yours. Your letters are sacred to me. Your pardon, my friend, that unknowingly I did break the seal. Will you not cover it again?" He held out the letter to me, and with a courteous bow handed me a clean envelope. I could only redirect it and hand it to him in silence. When he went out of the room, I could hear the key turn softly. A minute later, I went over and tried it, and the door was locked. When an hour or two after the Count came quietly into the room, his coming wakened me, for I had gone to sleep on the sofa. He was very courteous and very cheery in his manner, and seeing that I had been sleeping, he said, "So, my friend, you are tired? Get to bed. There is the surest rest. I may not have the pleasure to talk tonight, since there are many labours to me. But you will sleep, I pray." I passed to my room and went to bed, and, strange to say, slept without dreaming. Despair has its own calms. 31st May. This morning, when I awoke, I thought I would provide myself with some paper and envelopes from my bag and keep them in my pocket so that I might write in case I should get an opportunity. But again, a surprise. Again, a shock. Every scrap of paper was gone, and with it all my notes. My memoranda relating to railways and travel, my letter of credit, in fact all that might be useful to me were I once outside the castle. I sat and pondered a while, and then some thought occurred to me, and I made search of my portmanteau in the wardrobe where I had placed my clothes. The suit in which I had travelled was gone, and also my overcoat and rug. I could find no trace of them anywhere. This looked like some new scheme of villainy. 17th June. This morning, as I was sitting on the edge of my bed, cudgelling my brains, I heard without a cracking of whips and pounding and scraping of horses' feet up the rocky path beyond the courtyard. With joy, I hurried to the window and saw drive into the yard two great leiter wagons, each drawn by eight sturdy horses, and at the head of each pair, a Slovak with his wide hat, great nail-studded belt, dirty sheepskin and high boots. They had also their long staves in hand. I ran to the door, intending to descend and try to join them through the main hall, as I thought that way might be opened for them. Again, a shock. My door was fastened on the outside. Then I ran to the window and cried to them. They looked up at me, stupidly, and pointed. But just then the hetman of the Tsigani came out, and seeing them pointing to my window, said something, at which they laughed. Henceforth, no effort of mine, no piteous cry or agonized entreaty, would make them even look at me. They resolutely turned away. The leiter wagons contained great square boxes with handles of thick rope. These were evidently empty by the ease with which the Slovaks handled them and by their resonance as they were roughly moved. When they were all unloaded and packed in a great heap in one corner of the yard, the Slovaks were given some money by the Tsigani, and spitting on it for luck, lazily went each to his horse's head. Shortly afterwards, I heard the cracking of their whips die away in the distance. 24th June, before morning. Last night, the Count left me early and locked himself into his own room. As soon as I dared, I ran up the winding stair and looked out of the window, which opened south. I thought I would watch for the Count, for there is something going on. The Tsigani are quartered somewhere in the castle and are doing work of some kind. I know it, for now and then I hear a faraway muffled sound as of mattock and spade, and whatever it is, it must be the end of some ruthless villainy. I had been at the window somewhat less than half an hour when I saw something coming out of the Count's window. I drew back and watched carefully, and saw the whole man emerge. It was a new shock to me to find that he had on the suit of clothes which I had worn whilst travelling here, and slung over his shoulder the terrible bag which I had seen the woman take away. There could be no doubt as to his quest, and in my garb too. This, then, is his new scheme of evil, that he will allow others to see me, as they think, so that he may both leave evidence that I have been seen in the towns or villages posting my own letters, and that any wickedness which he may do shall, by the local people, be attributed to me. It makes me rage to think that this can go on, and whilst I am shut up here, a veritable prisoner, but without that protection of the law, which is even a criminal's right and consolation. I thought I would watch for the Count's return, and for a long time sat doggedly at the window. Then I began to notice that there were some quaint little specks floating in the rays of the moonlight. They were like the tiniest grains of dust, and they whirled round and gathered in clusters in a nebulous sort of way. I watched them with a sense of soothing, and a sort of calm stole over me. I leaned back in the embrasure in a more comfortable position so that I could enjoy more fully the aerial gambolling. Something made me start up, a low, piteous howling of dogs somewhere far below in the valley, which was hidden from my sight. Louder, it seemed to ring in my ears, and the floating motes of dust to take new shapes to the sound as they danced in the moonlight. I felt myself struggling to awake to some call of my instincts. Nay, my very soul was struggling, and my half-remembered sensibilities were striving to answer the call. I was becoming hypnotized. Quicker and quicker danced the dust. The moonbeams seemed to quiver as they went by me into the mass of gloom beyond. More and more they gathered till they seemed to take dim, phantom shapes. And then I started, broad awake and in full possession of my senses, and ran screaming from the place. The phantom shapes, which were becoming gradually materialized from the moonbeams, were those of the three ghostly women to whom I was doomed. I fled, and felt somewhat safer in my own room, where there was no moonlight and where the lamp was burning brightly. When a couple of hours had passed, I heard something stirring in the Count's room, something like a sharp wail quickly suppressed, and then there was silence, deep, awful silence, which chilled me. With a beating heart I tried the door, but I was locked in my prison and could do nothing. I sat down and simply cried. As I sat, I heard a sound in the courtyard without, the agonized cry of a woman. I rushed to the window and, throwing it up, peered out between the bars. There indeed was a woman with disheveled hair, holding her hands over her heart as one distressed with running. She was leaning against the corner of the gateway. When she saw my face at the window, she threw herself forward and shouted in a voice laden with menace, "Monster! Give me my child!" She threw herself on her knees and, raising up her hands, cried the same words in tones which wrung my heart. Then she tore her hair and beat her breast and abandoned herself to all the violences of extravagant emotion. Finally, she threw herself forward and, though I could not see her, I could hear the beating of her naked hands against the door. Somewhere high overhead, probably on the tower, I heard the voice of the Count calling in his harsh, metallic whisper. His call seemed to be answered from far and wide by the howling of wolves. Before many minutes had passed, a pack of them poured, like a pent-up dam when liberated, through the wide entrance into the courtyard. There was no cry from the woman, and the howling of the wolves was but short. Before long, they streamed away singly, licking their lips. I could not pity her, for I knew now what had become of her child, and she was better dead. What shall I do? What can I do? How can I escape from this dreadful thing of night and gloom and fear?
The music on the podcast is by David Beard. Visit his site at davidbeardmusic.com.
So there we are, listeners. That was Dracula, Episode 5. We will continue Chapter 4 in the next episode, which will go live on Monday. Until then, in case I don't see you in the meantime, until the moon rises again over Bram Stoker's Dracula, farewell.
Oh my God, that's just like so totally awesome.
This podcast has been brought to you today by you. Yes, you. And all my other sponsors at Patreon. Thank you for supporting me, and never forget that everything I produce from now on, be it on paper or on podcast, is as a result of your contribution.
Yeah! Woo! Woo, yeah!
I did a mini fist pump there, but obviously you couldn't see it.